Case number 12-5404 et al. Fadi al-Mukallaf, detainee, and Ahmed al-Mukallaf as next friend of Fadi al-Mukallaf, appellant versus Chuck Hagel, secretary, United States Department of Defense et al. Case number 12-5407. Amanatullah, detainee, and Abdul Razak as next friend to Amanatullah, appellant versus Barack Hussein Obama, president of the United States et al. Ms. Foster for appellants Fadi al-Mukallaf et al., Mr. Lewis for appellants Amanatullah et al., and Ms. Swingle for the appellees.
All right, Ms. Foster, good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Tina Foster of the International Justice Network, and I, along with my co-counsel here today, represent petitioners in the al-Mukallaf case, namely Fadi al-Mukallaf, Amin al-Bakri, and Reda al-Najjar. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal, and to give the court a bit of a roadmap, my colleague Eric Lewis, who will be arguing today on behalf of petitioner Amanatullah, will address two issues, the issues of evasion of judicial review and the absence of jurisdictional discovery. And in the interest of time, I will not repeat those arguments, but al-Mukallaf petitioners also make those arguments in our briefs. Your Honors, in the 3 years which have passed since...
I'm sorry, did you just say you would address evasion and discovery, or you wouldn't? You'll just rest on your briefs for that.
I will rest on our briefs for that, and Mr. Lewis will be arguing those in more detail.
Okay.
In the 3 years that have passed since the prior panel of this court reviewed these cases, there are three very significant facts which have changed. The first is that respondents have established a vast judicial complex at Bagram where thousands of trials have occurred. And thousands of criminal proceedings have occurred. Second, there is no longer any concern here about potential friction with the Afghan government as a result of allowing petitioners to seek habeas review in U.S. courts. And third, petitioners are among a very small group, subsection of about 60 detainees, who have been moved to a new facility at Bagram, which is operated without any Afghan authority or control.
Hasn't the United States said that it's not going to keep that permanently, or what's the status of that?
It has not said specifically what it wants to do with that prison. It is true that there have been representations by the government that there will not be permanent, that the U.S. government is not seeking permanent facilities in Afghanistan, but the fact that this prison exists as a separate prison where AUMF detainees like our clients who are non-Afghans
That's an argument that sort of cuts both ways, right? Because on the one hand, the United States has progressively ceded control over Bagram to Afghan authorities, and that would seem to hurt your argument based on Boumediene, right? And then but then you're left with the notion that there's de facto sovereignty over the Afghan prisoners, right? But if the United States, if it's not clear that the United States is going to keep them permanently, that's a slender reed you're grabbing, isn't
well,
it?
Well, first, Your Honor, permanent is not the standard that right. we're dealing with here. The standard in Boumediene is indefinite, mm-hmm. okay? So
indefinite is a slippery term, is it not?
Well,
talking about Guantanamo, indefinite seems to mean permanent unless there's some extraordinary cataclysm. You're not talking about indefinite here means something falling far short of that, right?
Well, Your Honor, these petitioners have been in custody for 13 years. Petitioner al-Mukallaf and petitioners al-Bakri and Najjar in the past 3 years have been through these.
I thought the indefiniteness came up in connection with the relationship between the United States and the place where the persons were held, not the duration of the holding. That's a separate element in on different matters, right?
I think it goes to both. I think the indefinite nature of the petitioner's confinement is what caused the Supreme Court concern in the cases that led up to Boumediene as well, in Hamdi and Hamdan.
Well, that indefiniteness is no different here, is it? I mean, it's no different from what it was in El Maqam.
I think there was a... In the previous record, there was still a chance that the U.S. government, when it transferred the thousands of prisoners to the Afghan government, that they would close their U.S. detention facility.
Now going back to the question of the place, the base,
yes,
the United
States'
relationship with the host government and the base. I thought we were trying to wrap up the question of the indefiniteness of detention.
I'm sorry, maybe
you took us away from that issue.
Sorry, maybe I misunderstood you.
I'm making the point that so far as the indefiniteness of the detention, the story is just the same as it was in our court's 2010 decision. No?
I don't think so, because if you mean the indefiniteness of the detention of these petitioners,
yes, that's what you shifted to. Just following you.
Okay, so the indefiniteness of these petitioners' detention also goes to the fact that there's already been a finding by the respondents in this case that these petitioners are eligible to be released from Bagram, but they have not been released from Bagram. And multiple occasions they've been found to be no longer necessary to be detained, yet they still languish at Bagram. And
that would suggest that something that's changed since the last time we heard this case is that some of them are more likely to be released.
No, Your Honor, because they've been...
Well, what about the indefiniteness of their detention is something we're supposed to look at, right? It's a concern that we have from Boumediene. What is there about the indefiniteness of their retention that is different today than the last time we heard this case in Al-Makala 1? How has it gotten more indefinite? Because if it's the same level of indefiniteness, you're not benefited from that. You have to show that somehow it's more indefinite.
Well, I think that when we were here previously, it could have been, and it was argued, that we were getting out of the detention business in Afghanistan, and now we have a both shift in the practical or the factual basis, in that the detention facility has those that are going to be transferred to Afghan custody have been transferred to Afghan custody. And those that remain at Bagram, for our clients at least, there's been a determination that they don't need to be there. There's no military necessity for them to be there. Yet, for several years, they still remain there. And I would posit that the fact that they've been cleared yet still remain is even more evidence of the indefinite nature of their detention.
Do you know why they haven't been released?
No, Your Honor. I mean, I think it's a political...
In other cases, it's been a matter of somebody's cleared for release, but they can't find a place that will accept them.
That's not at issue here, because the Yemeni government, for example, with respect has been following this case and are here today, they want their citizens to have some sort of legal process or to be released. They're willing, and they have taken and made assurances that they will guarantee that these individuals will pose no threat if they are released to Yemeni custody.
Let me shift and ask you a question, because I know your time's limited. So we have these three factors in Boumediene that we're supposed to apply. It's not clear to me how we're supposed to weight them. I mean, I don't think there's any guidance saying three is more important and two is more important than one. There's no guidance given to us. But it sure seems like, number three, the practicalities is what drives a lot of the Supreme Court precedent and certainly our precedent on this. And of those, the practicality that concerns me most is that we're in an active war zone here, right? And going back to Eisentrager, when Justice Jackson wrote his opinion, it seems as if the aspect of it being in a war zone that troubled him most was the fact that you were going to be allowing the decisions of military commanders to be second-guessed in a civilian court. He used the phrase that it would diminish the prestige of the military commanders. It doesn't seem to me that you've addressed that concern. You've talked about some changes in the theater of war, but what about that fact that seemed to trouble Justice Jackson most?
Well, I think that...
You're still in a war zone, and you would have the decisions of military commanders second-guessed by civilian court.
Well, Your Honor, if it turned on only that practical obstacle of second-guessing military commanders, yeah. Boumediene would not have come out the way that it did, because Boumediene made some comments about the war zone, but it also allowed those petitioners who were being held under the AUMF to have habeas review. So if that alone is the reason, that can't be it under Boumediene. What we argue is that there were actually three different reasons why the Court of Appeals was concerned before. They do mention the Eisentrager language that you're talking about prestige of commanders, but there's really no evidence here that at this point, for these detainees who were not captured presumably by the military, they were rendered from CIA black sites to Bagram, and just happened to now be in military custody, that for these petitioners there would be no difference of opinion between judicial and military decision making that would potentially hurt the prestige of commanders. I think the concerns about the active theater of war, while Afghanistan is still an active theater of war, the fact that there's an entire judicial complex with thousands of trials going on there demonstrates that in and of itself is not a logistical concern or a practical concern. And finally...
If Afghans are going to be tried by Afghans, it pretty much has to happen in Afghanistan, right?
Right, but they're not...
There's no way that can be shifted to some other venue. So... the government reasonably believes that fostering a judicial system in Afghanistan is good policy. What else could they do?
Well, Your Honor,
regardless of possible negative impacts of it.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, they chose to build the facility inside of Bagram. There were Afghan courts and
armies. That may have been the least unsafe place they could find.
Well, there are, and there continue to be plenty of Afghan courts open for business all over Afghanistan. These are not the first Afghan courts. They were just built specifically for this detainee population. And the courts are open for business in Afghanistan, and the courts are open for business at Bagram, inside the base. The only, for the government to argue that somehow the base is, you know, because there are bombs going off in Afghanistan and there's military conflict there, that precludes habeas review on behalf of practical.
I don't know if anyone's saying it precludes it. The argument essentially is that it raises the hazards associated with it.
Well, I think that the standard in Boumediene is that it would have to be, the practical obstacles would have to be so great that it would be impractical and anomalous. Here we have... These petitioners are, it would not be anomalous. What's anomalous is that this small group of petitioners are being held without trial because they happen to be in the U.S. facility, while all the thousands of other Bagram detainees get access to full criminal proceedings in the Afghan section of the prison. So in terms of the burdens on the government, which the government argues are great. They haven't pointed to a single burden other than additional expenditure of resources that would render this impractical and anomalous. If you think about what would happen in a habeas proceeding, it's far less than what would happen in a criminal trial proceeding. You would have a proceeding here in Washington, D.C. Counsel would come and make representations and on behalf of the petitioner. You would not have the concerns that were the concerns you know, of the Eisentrager Court, for example, and rationing, billeting of rations and shipping space and things like that that were of concern at that time. So for the logistical part of the equation, the fact that Bagram is within a conflict zone should not does not pose the kind of practical obstacles that the court was concerned with in Boumediene. In terms of the relationship with the Afghan government, which I think is another concern that the prior panel based its decision on, we also know that the factual predicate there is no longer true. They were concerned that it might cause friction with the Afghan government for a habeas court in this country to extend jurisdiction. But in fact, we now have on the record a statement from a formal letter confirming the position of the Afghan government.
And what are we to make of that? I mean, we get a letter from the chief of staff. I mean, is that how we take notice of what foreign governments have to say?
Well, Your Honor, it's the only...
Because there's news articles that suggest something different. That's not what we rely on. I mean, just in Zivotofsky, we just decided, and we said this a couple of times, that the way that courts figure out what foreign governments, who they are and what they do, is through the executive branch gets to decide that. We don't get to decide that. So what are we to make of this,
well, the executive,
this letter?
The executive branch has made no representation that it's anything other than what is in Mr. Karam's letter.
Well, we'll hear from them. Okay.
And in fact, they can't, because that is the position of the Afghan government.
It would seem to me that the strength of that letter turns on the proposition that the Karzai's chief of staff is almost the same as Karzai. But if Karzai's chief of staff is almost the same as Karzai, why doesn't he just produce a letter from Karzai?
Well, Your Honor, if we could have gotten a meeting with Karzai himself, we would have done that. But
well,
this is his alter ego.
And the fact that you couldn't suggest that he's not Karzai's alter ego.
We've cited in our briefs the Afghan government's characterization of what the office of the chief of staff does, and in fact it does speak on behalf of Karzai, and that site is in our briefs. So there's no question that he was speaking on behalf of President Karzai, and frankly, the only evidence that the court has in front of it on this record is this letter. There is no other representation that has been made. On our side, we have a letter from Karzai's chief of staff stating that he speaks on behalf of the Afghan government and confirming their position. And on the other side, we have nothing. All we have is a representation by respondents' counsel that it might not represent Karzai's position. If Karzai's chief of staff was speaking out of turn or was not authorized to speak that or misrepresented the position of the Afghan government, the U.S. government is in a far better position to get a letter to contradict that or a statement to contradict that. Instead, all they've cited to is a newspaper article which predates the letter that we have and actually doesn't contradict it at all. The position of the Afghan government with respect to Afghan detainees has not changed in that, and the position of the Afghan government with respect to other detainees that don't fall into this category of people like our clients who are rendered from third countries as far away as Thailand and brought against their will into Afghanistan. His letter explains very clearly that the Afghan government didn't have a role in bringing those individuals there and does not have any desire for them to be indefinitely detained at a new Guantanamo inside of Afghanistan.
All right, let me stop you. Judge, do you have any more questions? Judge Williams? All right, over your time. We'll give you a couple minutes.
Okay.
All right. Mr. Lewis?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I represent Petitioner Amanatullah. Amanatullah was detained in Iraq by British forces and was ultimately sent from Iraq to Afghanistan in late 2004 or 2005, after Rasool was decided, and after, as we put in evidence, the policy changed with respect to sending detainees to Guantanamo. It picks up on two questions that were asked, one by Judge Griffith and one by Judge Williams. You talked about Justice Jackson's opinion in Eisentrager and second-guessing the military. Justice Scalia's dissent accused the majority of doing just that, and it is clear that the majority opinion in Boumediene limited Johnson versus Eisentrager to a focus on practical obstacles and not on those factors of giving aid and comfort to the enemy. But in any event, the only military who could potentially be second-guessed here would be the British military and not the United States military, because they detained them and they're in possession of the facts. And with respect to Judge Williams' point with regarding the trial of Afghans in Afghanistan, the trial of Amanatullah would be held in Washington, and it would have there'd be no facts that we know of that would be in Afghanistan. We know nothing about Amanatullah or why he was detained.
One of the affidavits that you've submitted refers to intelligence purposes as being one of the reasons why detainees were moved to Bagram. And that suggests that documents are collected at Bagram relating to them.
Well, we do know that the detainee is given an unclassified summary of facts, but the government won't let us talk to our client. So we don't know what that summary of facts are, but presumably that is committed to writing, and that is more than likely to be on a database across the river. Most of the proceedings that have gone on have been done on the papers and on the basis of affidavits. The government is perfectly able to put in affidavits when it chooses. It's chosen not to put in any information about why he was captured or why he was sent to Afghanistan. Surely there were no shortage of places to detain him in Iraq, where the war is now over. I'd like to turn quickly to the evasion evidence. In addition...
Well, let me ask you the legal significance of evasion. So here in Boumediene, evasion was rife, right? I mean, that's why Guantanamo was created. Why didn't the Supreme Court look at that as a factor in Boumediene?
Well,
they didn't say anything about it.
Yes. In developing the test, the Supreme Court said there were at least three factors. But in developing the test, on the very same page of the opinion, the Supreme Court said, first, the political branches do not have the power, quote, to turn the Constitution on and off at will. And I think this is important. The test for determining the scope of this provision must not be subject to manipulation by those whose power it is designed to restrain. That's at pages 765 and 766. That is exactly what happened here. We have put in unrebutted evidence of manipulation.
Affidavits supported that proposition. The affidavits taken at their strongest said that the consideration of avoiding habeas, of course it's all remote from the actual decision makers, was in part based on consideration of avoiding habeas. But there's specific mention of other purposes. And whenever you say that something is in part based on a particular factor, that's got to mean that there's an array of cases where that factor is unnecessary to the decision, plus some cases where it is critical. So it looks as if one has at most an array of different decisions, some of which were influenced by this. Is your argument that's enough?
I'd like to answer that question in three ways. First, I'd like to supplement that with Colonel Bavarnik's piece in 2010, who was chairman of the Judge Advocate General College's International Law Department, who wrote, in September 2004, after the Supreme Court's June 2004 rulings in Rasool and Hamdi, it appears a policy decision was made to stop transferring detainees from Afghanistan to Gitmo. We would submit that that is sufficient under a Rule 12b1 standard, where it is our burden under the preponderance of the evidence. And we have put forward plausible evidence of a change in policy to stop sending people from Bagram to Guantanamo and to keep them there and we put in further evidence of an intent to evade, particularly in our case. You have to consider under Bermedian individually. In our case, you had someone who was captured.
You aren't, just a second, you aren't arguing that the ability of Al-Makala to Bagram is to be decided detainee by detainee.
We are arguing that the Bermedian test must be decided on an individualized basis. So, for example, with...
Not base by base, but detainee by detainee.
Well, if a detainee is captured in Iraq, where there are plenty of places to keep him, and he's taken out of one war zone and flown in at great cost and risk to another war zone, and then the government says, sorry, we can't release him because he's in a war zone, we are saying that is part of the practical factors and obstacles, as well as considering whether in his case there has been manipulation. On a Rule 12b1 standard, when the government has put in no contrary evidence, indeed the government could have put an affidavit saying that's not why we did it. Instead, it said it may have been based on other considerations.
Your argument essentially means that the jurisdictional question would have to be decided not merely in two decisions of the district court or two decisions of the Court of Appeals, but innumerable decisions based on the particular facts relating to an individual detainee.
I would suggest, Your Honor, that when there are unique facts, like somebody captured in a place where ordinary military procedure would have detained him in the place where he's captured, and something anomalous happens, he's transferred out, that is a unique circumstance which requires particular consideration in his case. I'd like to make one other quick point. The government, the court below apparently never considered all of the evidence with respect to purposeful evasion, in part because of confusion. Chief Judge Lambert said, well, most of this information was publicly available when the petitioners presented their case to the Court of Appeals. That was one of his grounds for denying on purposeful evasion. We were not before the Court of Appeals. This is our first time. So it's clear that in applying the Rule 12b1 standard, the court not only failed to accept our allegations as truthful and to take our inferences as warranted, particularly when the government did not refute it, which is the government's burden if the court is going to consider evidence. It appears that Chief Judge Lambert was under the impression that we had been up on Makala 2 when we had not. We would submit that alone submits grounds for remand so that we can get a proper consideration under a proper Rule B12 standard of the evasion evidence.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Ms. Swingle.
May it please the Court, Sharon Swingle from the Department of Justice for the government respondents. I'd like to begin, if I may, with this question of purposeful evasion. I think, Judge Williams, your questions raise the very meaningful inquiry about whether this Court, in its prior Al-Makala decision, envisioned that the question of habeas jurisdiction at Bagram would be an individual-by-individual determination. And I think the Court did not. I think what the Court held there was that it would not accept a theory of evasion that would have, in essence, no limiting principle, because, of course, when this Court previously decided the question, the petitioners had argued that the government's decision to hold individuals who were captured outside of Afghanistan at Bagram reflected some obvious desire to evade the habeas jurisdiction recognized by the Supreme Court in Boumediene. And this Court...
Apart from the evidentiary problems, is there a legal problem here? Is this something we're supposed to... Is this the type of manipulation that Boumediene warned us to look for?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. To the extent...
Why not?
Well, if I may, I think the historic case law, the historic common law case law, recognizes in some limited instances a theory of evasion where an individual who is within the the court's power at the time the habeas petition is filed is then spirited outside of the jurisdiction.
There's a really good dissenting opinion on that in Kiemba.
Indeed. But, I don't think the court in Beaumedienne necessarily envisioned more than that. I think it's not clear. But the court cannot have meant that
so,
simply...
So you're saying that there's a distinction when the executive, when someone is not within the court's jurisdiction and the executive... make certain that he stays there, as opposed to one that's within habeas jurisdiction. It's clear that when somebody's within habeas jurisdiction, the king can't spirit them off to get outside of habeas jurisdiction. That's clear. That's part and parcel of the great writ. How is that really any different functionally from keeping someone from going within the jurisdiction in the first place?
Well, if I may, Your Honor, I think this court in its prior decision made clear that whatever the theory may be, it would not be one that had no limiting principle. And I think it's evident that the theory here is if you choose to keep someone at a place where there is not recognized habeas jurisdiction, that that's out, somehow would be a basis for worldwide jurisdiction. I mean, I think this theory would extend to every...
The rule would be that in the absence of factors independent of the habeas issue, it would be no problem with the government's decision, right? So that isn't, I don't think that's eliminable.
No, but I do think the court envisioned a quite narrow exception, and whatever that exception is, I think there isn't an evidentiary basis for it here at a minimum because there's no...
Well, how about if you have evidence that the reason someone is being transferred to Bagram is so that they'll escape judicial review? What if you have clear evidence of that? What's that case look like?
If I may, Your Honor, I guess I would answer in two ways. First, as a historic matter, it would not simply be enough to have someone outside the jurisdiction. To the extent there's a historic basis for this exception, it's one in which... the evasion, as it were, happens after the writ is filed.
Evasion is evasion.
Manipulation
is manipulation. I can't believe that's a difference that's going to make a distinction that's going to make a big difference.
But I think at
a minimum, if the executive is manipulating here, they're manipulating.
Well, Your Honor, to be frank, I think there just is no evidentiary basis for making that claim here. So I think it's really not properly presented before the court as the district court.
That's why I was distinguishing the evidentiary from the legal, and I thought you were talking about the legal basis for it.
I think we would.
So you're conceding that if there's a case of manipulation, that falls within the sort of concern that Boumediene said we need to look at?
I am conceding that it could be a concern, but I think this court need not grapple with what the scope of that exception would be or how it would apply because of the absence of an evidentiary foundation here. Okay. And I think the court, in its prior decision, really did that already.
We would have to say, to come out your way, we would have to say that the evidence presented by the petitioners is insufficient under some principle that you have to articulate what that principle is.
Well, I guess I think the court has already, in essence, decided this question in its earlier decision by pointing out that to the extent they were arguing evasion, it was unsupported by either the evidence or reason, and I think there really is nothing new here. Obviously, the court in its prior decision did express some skepticism about how evasion would work in tandem with the Boumediene factors or whether it would be an additional factor, but I think just as when this case was previously before the court, it's really not presented full square based on the lack of an evidentiary basis for the argument here. And I think, of course, the absence of any limiting principle.
And what's the particular deficiency in the evidentiary basis that you see? They've offered these affidavits. What's deficient?
So if I may, as the court itself pointed out in its questioning, the affidavits talk about several reasons for having people in Afghanistan.
Intelligence
being one of them. None of them, and that makes sense. I mean, in the court's earlier decision, we had argued and pointed out why the decision where to put someone is primarily a military judgment. There are a very limited number of long-term detention facilities worldwide that the U.S. uses, and to the extent they exist, they are considerably closer than the other. I mean, Bagram is much closer to the places of detention. But in addition, those affidavits say nothing about these individual petitioners. There is no firsthand knowledge about any of the petitioners now before the court, and it's just speculation. Our view is it wouldn't meet the standards in Iqbal for stating a claim, and certainly no lesser standard would apply to establish jurisdiction.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you have a high assistant secretary Powell these detainees.
Well, if I may, Your Honor, he said this was a factor for individuals who were transferred to Guantanamo. He then says something akin to, it became apparent to me that the decision to hold people at Bagram must have been motivated. I mean, it's entirely speculative.
There's no personal knowledge there, you're saying.
Yeah. No evidentiary factual basis that would explain why that inference was a reasonable one. It, very closely akin to the claim of wrongful discriminatory intent in Iqbal that the court held was not sufficient to give rise to a plausible inference. And here, too, it could have been the decision to keep people at Bagram was made with the knowledge that habeas jurisdiction had not yet been extended there, but without any specific intent to divest individuals of jurisdiction. So I think that just doesn't present anything more than this court previously found was insufficient to raise the question. And, of course, the timing is such that because the transfer decisions were made here for all of the petitioners except Hamidullah before Boumediene and in some cases before Rasool, it kind of boils down to an idea that once a court has held that there is habeas jurisdiction at some non-U.S. location and not others, then if you don't transfer them...
But your argument is allowing for the fact that a different petitioner with a different set of facts may
raising
something that would concern us.
The question would then be presented under Boumediene in a way it isn't quite yet.
I'm sorry. You sound as if you were embracing the idea
that No, I just think to the extent a court were ever to find a situation in which a detainee at a place where habeas jurisdiction weren't generally available might present a special case, it would require a factual showing that isn't before the court. You know, Boumediene, I think, leaves open this question of what the significance of an intentional evasion of the writ might be. And I think this court's prior decision leaves open what the significance might be in a particular case. But whatever would be required to raise that question, I think, this is not the record to do it. And this court really has already recognized that, and the district court did as well. If I may turn to the third Boumediene factor, the practical obstacles, which this court previously held weighed overwhelmingly against habeas jurisdiction, I'd like to just discuss briefly the reasons why that factor is not meaningfully different.
Can I ask you, your opposing counsel, in response to my question about the Justice Jackson's language about the prestige of the military commander, suggested that the prestige of the military commander is going to be called into question whether the proceeding takes place at Guantanamo or somewhere else. That it's not that factor is not linked to the fact that the detention itself is in a war zone. Would you respond to that?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I don't think that's correct, and I don't think that's a fair reading of Boumediene. Boumediene itself recognizes that an active war zone would present a completely different context, and I think that's just crystal clear from its decision. That was the basis on which it distinguished Eisentrager.
But why would this one factor vary, or would this one factor vary depending on the site of the detention, the fact that a decision of a military commander is being called into question by a civilian court? Why would the resolution of that turn on whether the detention site is in a war zone or not?
Well, I would answer that a couple of different ways. I think, one, the risk at issue when you're talking about somebody who is being held attendant to active combat operations is simply greater in those circumstances. Obviously, these individuals here are being held attendant to a conflict where we have 60,000 troops on the ground.
That's risk, but if you're not answering my question, is the prestige of the military command. That's what bothered Justice Jackson.
It was, Your Honor, and I must confess I find that part of the decision somewhat opaque.
Okay.
I assume it is calling into question a military judgment about the need for continued detention in the course of running and controlling leading combat operations. It is not simply, you know, the judgment of the U.S. military writ large, but it is really...
So in that case, that's not a factor that we ought to look at with these petitioners, because they're not in the middle of a military operation place. And
I don't think that's correct, Your Honor. They are being held at an area of active combat operations with 60,000 troops on the ground and strikes
every day.
Well,
but I thought you just suggested that maybe the best reading of Justice Jackson is that he was concerned about an ongoing military operation. You pick someone up on the battlefield and you shouldn't have to put them, they shouldn't have access to a civilian court while you're, you know, taking them back to captivity or whatever.
I think I want to be clear here. These are individuals who are held in connection with the active hostilities. So I think we do face that very situation. I mean, I think you know, were we to continue to hold them post-resolution of an active combat role in Afghanistan, we would be in a different situation potentially. But that is the circumstances in which they are being held here.
Okay.
I think there is a particular problem with this argument, too, because, of course, not only are we in the midst of active combat operations, but we are in the process of trying to wind down those operations. And so the argument here is that at the same time that we are attempting to facilitate the Afghan government's ability to take over detention operations in Bagram, to remove the bulk of our troops from Bagram, to get ourselves out of the detention business, we are being asked to stand up brand new habeas courts, to provide for access to habeas counsel, to facilitate access to classified information. These are all things that are extremely difficult to do under the best of circumstances, for example, at Guantanamo. And the notion that we would be doing this in an active war zone at a place where we are increasingly having less and less control, I think is just not consistent with this court's prior decision. If I could just briefly address this question about the petitioners being cleared for release here, I want to be clear, there is no allegation, and the petitioners have not claimed otherwise, that any of them has been found not to be lawfully subject to detention. What they are claiming here is that the detainee review boards have then, as a discretionary matter, found that other measures might mitigate the risk they pose, whether that be transfer to another country for criminal prosecution or some sort of rehabilitation program. I think this court's cases are clear that that does not mean that detention is no longer lawful under the AUMF and the laws of war, and obviously that kind of determination is one that might require extensive coordination or consultation with foreign governments to effectuate. If the court has no further questions, we would ask it to affirm.
All right, thank you. Ms. Foster has no time? All right, why don't you take 2 minutes?
I'll let my colleague address Petitioner Latula's specific evasion arguments, but one point I wanted to point out in our briefs is that it's not Amakala petitioner's argument is not just that the that there's evasion that happened at the time when they were brought to Bagram. There's ongoing evasion going on here because they continue to be held in Bagram despite, as counsel said, they're winding down in Afghanistan. There's no nexus between these petitioners and this active war zone. I also wanted to...
Sorry. In what sense? I mean, your own affidavits indicate that intelligence purposes would account for, in part, for these transfers into Bagram. Are you saying those intelligence purposes are now moved?
Well, they after 13 years, it's hard to imagine what intelligence value any individual could have. You know, that my client, Fadi Al-Makala, was a young man when he got there. He was 18 at the time. Now he's 30 years old. So it's hard to see what intelligence value they could have. And secondly, I would say that in holding somebody for intelligence value is not a permissible...
That's not the question. Whether it's permissible is not the question. But it certainly must be permissible in terms of this question of manipulation to locate people in a place where their intelligence value can be used.
Well, that has not
been used fairly readily.
Well, Your Honor, I would say that respondents have not argued that these people have not given any reason why these people are being held in Bagram. We are saying that there was a policy in practice.
They believe that you haven't made a sufficient case to.
Well, that brings me to the other point, which is that Iqbal, which is cited here for the first time in the Court of Appeals, which was not cited as the standard of review by Judge Bates, nor did he consider that. It's an inappropriate extension here. The Iqbal standard has to do with 12b-6. We're in a 12b-1 posture, so I think...
You don't deny that this is a war zone, right?
No, it's
I noticed warzone. Maybe it was just reflexive, but you used your hands and used scare quotes around war zone. You said war zone.
No, if there is a war zone, but it is a war zone. But I'm not saying it's like, you know, the street outside here, but it's also it's not so much of a war zone that you can't have thousands of trials going on there daily. So that's my only point.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Lewis, why don't you take 1 minute?
Thank you, Your Honor. There's never been a case that I'm aware of like these cases where there's been such a vacuum of information, where the government has chosen not to offer anything. There have been CSRTs, DRBs. Every case has had some factual premise underlying it before we discuss a Rule 12b1 motion. This is on a Rule 12b motion. The government says, well, you don't have personal knowledge evidence of why these petitioners were transferred. First of all, they would not be allowed, Colonel Wilkerson and Mr. Carl would not be allowed to give evidence of specific individuals. The government knows why, it chooses not to. I just want to say with respect to the to say why, and it doesn't even make a conclusion. It just says there could be other reasons. On a Rule 12b1 motion, this court's precedents in both the Herbert and the Ignatieff case say the goal of a 12b1 motion is to have a full airing of the facts. And while there is no discovery as of right to in habeas petitions, it's within the sound discretion of the courts. And when a party is prejudiced by having one party control all the information and not give it to the other.
So you're saying the district court abused their discretion in not granting that, you the...
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. Yeah. No ability to talk to our client, no unclassified facts, all of which could easily have been turned over. The government made a strategic decision that would not tell me and it would not tell this court anything about why this person was apprehended. They just say he was part of the hostilities. Well, he was picked up in Iraq. The Iraq hostilities are over. They say, well, there may be...
That's not what the newspaper
is. Is that right?
They're over as it concerns the United States of America. It's not that any of us are going to go visit, but the United States has withdrawn. With respect to intelligence gathering, the plurality opinion in Hamdi says, although intelligence is permissible there, indefinite detention for purposes of intelligence is not permitted.
That is not the issue before us. It came up simply as one of the factors weighing on decisions as to where detainees should be held. By the affidavits that you submitted.
I don't think the government can plausibly contend that a Pakistani picked up by the British in Iraq can offer intelligence for Afghanistan. They haven't contended it, and I don't think they can. Thank you, Your Honor.
Conflict in Iraq is totally independent from the conflict in Afghanistan.
Indeed it is, Your Honor.
All right, thank you.